bringing you the truth behind the news. Welcome to The New American.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Paul Dragoo. We're glad you joined us. We've covered a lot of important stories this week, and for this episode, we want to highlight some of those that didn't get top billing in our lineup, but could have easily done so. We're going to start out with a story about racism masquerading around as equity in Seattle. Then we go to Wisconsin, where the governor just vetoed legislation protecting girls' sports, while Oregon, on the other hand, is backtracking on absurd legislation that passed 3 years ago. We're also going to analyze the incredible feat Republicans are on the verge of accomplishing by losing the House in the middle of a Congress. And to cap it all off, Stephen Gary discussed the difference between non-interventionism and isolationism. Enjoy. The Seattle School Board has closed its gifted program in district schools because it had too many white and Asian students. This is obviously racist, but it's okay because racism against whites is now acceptable. The gifted programs are known as Highly Capable Cohort, or HCC schools. They're designed to reward the intelligence and work ethic of diligent students, no matter their race, with an accelerated path that goes beyond the low standards of regular classrooms. Now, getting into one of these programs required rigorous review, including standardized testing, teacher recommendations, and a consistently exceptional academic record. So how did these gifted programs become a bad thing? Well, in 2015, Seattle Public Schools hired an equity specialist to address so-called racial inequities. District records show that more than 50% of students enrolled in these programs were white and up to 16% were Asian, but that was not good enough for Black Lives Matter. The Marxist activists then spearheaded a drive to end the gifted program. During the 2020 to 2021 school year of COVID lockdowns, the district voted to shutter the gifted program despite objections from parents, including those who were Black, Asian, and Hispanic. The phase-out began in 2021 and is scheduled to be completed by the 2027-28 school year. KTTH Conservative Talk Radio quoted one father who said during a school board meeting that shuttering the program is a disservice to the minorities who were in the program. But according to reporting from Seattle's The Stranger, school board director Chandra Hampton then accused those non-white parents of being tokenized and used by white parents. Yeah, you can't make this stuff up. In an article approving the program shuttering, the Seattle Times said that the school district is replacing the gifted program with a whole classroom model where all students are in the same classroom and the teacher individualizes learning plans for each student. It's called the Highly Capable Neighborhood School Model. But if the teachers must recognize gifted students in their classes and design individualized lesson plans for them, are they going to choose children based on skin color rather than merit? Right, none of this makes sense, but it's not supposed to. This sort of nonsense is right out of the Soviet playbook. Researcher Irina Volkova of Moscow's National Research University Higher School of Economics published a 2018 study praising education in the Soviet Union. Yeah, she really did. And she wrote, "Keeping in mind the idea of equal possibilities for children to get quality education, the Council of People's Commissars ordered in 1937 the Commissariat for Education to abolish the so-called exemplary schools for gifted children, turning them into regular, comprehensive schools accessible for all." Perhaps this is why that area of the world hasn't turned out a Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, or Tchaikovsky in over a century. So this looks like where Seattle's going. So joining me for this story is Editor-in-Chief of The New American Magazine, Gary Benoit, and JBS Research Manager, Christian Gomez. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hey, Paul.
Thanks for having us on.
So, Gary, this is what it looks like when the revolutionaries are taking over, isn't it?
Yes.
Thank you for that compliment.
That is a very succinct answer, but it just leaves you shaking your head, doesn't it? And it really lets you know that the real purpose is not to benefit the children who are in these
or
schools.
Society.
Or society as a whole. Obviously, there is a program in the government schools that is intended to dumb down to the point where the children, as they grow up, will not be people who will be capable of being able to think for themselves. There will not be people who will be able to make informed decisions when they go into voting booths. Not people capable of continuing a free society. And it's all by design. Mm-hmm. And I would leapfrog what the left is doing by getting rid of this exceptional school.
Yeah.
I would say, let's get out of the public school system altogether and let's have private education.
Well, if this, I mean, it feels like we do a story like this at least once a week. And, mm-hmm. and then we always like, yeah, get them out. And you should. You really should. You should. This is another example. But this reminds me of a conversation that I had with a distant relative of mine. I don't know if everyone listening or watching here, like I was born in Romania and, you know, we had to get out of there because it was communist. And my parents were like, well, that stinks. You know, we don't want to grow up here. But anyway, I have a distant relative who's older. And he told me stories about, not that he was there at the time, but he's a historical buff. And he told me stories about how when the communists came to power in Romania, one of the first things they did is they obviously ousted all the capable, all the intelligent people and whatnot. And he said what they brought in, and I'm not sure I'm using the right translation, but they brought in the nitwits, right? And so these people, a lot of them were certified criminals. You know, they'd emptied out some of the prisons and things like that. And their main attribute wasn't intelligence. It wasn't the ability to be productive. Their main attribute was that they had to be loyal to the party and they had to be able to do whatever it takes. And that explains why that part of the country, it was, you know, especially during the communist years, it never produced anything. I mean, it was barely able to feed its people. Christian, what do you think of all this madness?
I think of this as a Marxist agenda that's driven by a desire for DEI and checking boxes, and it's ultimately destructive. And what you said about Romania is true of every communist country in history, including communist China. They accuse those who are academically minded and intelligent of being brainwashed by bourgeois capitalist propaganda, and they put people who are not educated in certain areas or fields to be in place in those areas, like they in communist China. And I know that Steve has mentioned this a lot, Steve Bonta, that they would take the farmers and have them go into the cities and perform surgeries and have the surgeons do farm work to make it more equitable. And what you ended up was people dying in hospital beds and no food being produced. And that's what we're seeing happening in America slowly in places like Seattle, all over the country, as this woke DEI agenda is just pushed on us.
Yeah, I mean, and one person who's been really concerned, speaking of that, about this has been, for instance, Elon Musk. He's gotten a lot of attention for that because he's essentially saying, and I think his comments have specifically focused on the medical field. And he's like, if we continue to push this DEI nonsense, people are going to die. And I think he also said that about the aviation industry because, you know, doors were flying off.
Oh, yeah.
Off the airplanes, the tires are coming off, and you just like left scratching your head. I do want to also point out something that when these revolutionaries, you know, the masterminds at the top, they're not as dumb as the stormtroopers on the bottom. But what they do is they normally get these folks who, I don't want to be mean, but, you know, who don't have a whole lot of skin in the game, who haven't necessarily found a place in society. So they're naturally kind of ticked off. There's anxiety. There's frustration with the current system. So those people are easy to brainwash, but more importantly, they're easy to weaponize because now you're going to weaponize them against the ruling or the system that already exists. And so it's easy to take those people and weaponize them against that because they're already losers. And, you know, these Black Lives Matter people, for the most part, they're losers. And the people on the streets who are brainwashed by this stuff, they're losers. And so you take those people and those are your stormtroopers. That's sure. Essentially what's happening.
And you can say they're not only losers, but they're also stooges.
Yeah.
Because what they're doing is really not operating in their own self-interest. They don't realize it, of course.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're simply pawns.
Yeah.
And their purpose is to destroy the existing order so that the people who are really manipulating things, the people at the top, are able to build on the ashes of that existing order,
yeah,
the new world order that they want to create where they'll have absolute and total power.
I would say that they're victims, but not in the way that the communists say that they're victims, but they're victims in the sense that they're being duped mm-hmm. by the communists. They take advantage of the fact that they lack education. They're not well educated on the issue at hand, mm-hmm. and they use it to their advantage, and they intentionally agitate them. They create agitation and division and get these people, the so-called have-nots, to be yeah. angry of what they don't have. And thus they make them these false promises. If we come to power, you know, you'll get a plot of land, you'll get your own farm or whatever the promise is. We'll cut the pie from the 1% and make sure you get your equal fair share. And we've seen the results of that.
It doesn't always work that way. Does
exactly.
It usually does not work that way. The revolution consumes its own.
Yes, it does.
And programs or situations like this, developments like this, and then government schools, they perpetuate this lack of understanding, this lack of education. So it increases the probability that folks who grow up in the society might not be as successful because they had inferior education, if they had any at all, because they were indoctrinated, because they were taught nonsense like this about inequality, and then they become the revolution. Thank you, guys.
All right, parents, listen up. We've all seen the countless examples of how radical leftists have been destroying American schools. It's no longer just about the terrible math and reading levels. Now radical left teachers birthed from liberal universities are forcing gender indoctrination in kindergarten. They're teaching lessons on white guilt.
Freedom Project Academy has perfected live online learning over the course of a decade. I get a ton of great feedback about this program, a ton.
They're built on Judeo-Christian values, a classical curriculum. What does that mean? It means they're taught, your children are taught the way that the founding generations of the country. My own son, Noah, did Freedom Project Academy for several years when he was younger.
The more we tell our friends about these things, the more people will get on board. And I believe that we can be the catalyst to some real change.
We must save the West. Our way of life and our culture is under attack. And because of patriots like you and your project, I have optimism for the future.
On Tuesday, the governor of Wisconsin vetoed a bill that would have banned girls and boys from mixing in sports. The Republican-controlled legislature had passed the bill because they believe the state should step in and protect women's school sports, and because they recognize that biological differences between male and female bodies are too great to dismiss. Imagine that. But Democratic Governor Tony Evers believes that politics trumps thousands of years of established human biology. With his veto, he displayed his ability to play the perfect stooge for those who push this nonsense onto the public. He justified the veto this way. This type of legislation and the harmful rhetoric beget by pursuing it harms LGBTQ Wisconsinites and kids' mental health, emboldens anti-LGBTQ harassment, bullying, and violence, and threatens the safety and dignity of LGBTQ Wisconsinites, especially our LGBTQ kids. Yeah, he really said LGBTQ that much. The sad irony, of course, is that the trans nonsense that he supports is harming people, including the mentally ill, who are just pawns in the pursuit of an anti-human agenda. Last week, we reported on leaked internal documents from WPATH, the corrupt organization that creates medical standards for trans procedures. The documents confirm that trans procedures are permanently harming people who are too young or too mentally ill or both to make these types of decisions. They also reveal that the people responsible for these standards know the long-term harm they're causing. Now, meanwhile, in Oregon, they're actually backtracking on idiotic legislation. On Monday, Oregon's Democratic governor signed a law recriminalizing drug possession. It only took 3 years for reality to override witless utopian ideals. In 2021, Oregon became the first state to decriminalize drug possession. But apparently, that didn't work out too well. As The Hill reported, the state has recently faced a large rise in overdose deaths and had the second highest rate of substance abuse in the U.S. So, how long before states begin backtracking on pro-trans legislation? TNA's Rebecca Terrell, who's with us right now, recently interviewed Landon Starbuck, the producer of the film The War on Children. The documentary exposes the transgender attack being waged against children through education, entertainment, news, politics, big tech, medicine, nonprofits, and the industries that finance them. Here's Starbuck discussing what she learned while working on the movie.
Normal people are sick of this garbage, and they're looking for ways to save their families, to change their children's mindsets, pull them away from indoctrination centers. They're making plans. And, you know, for parents that have pushback and feel overwhelmed, you know, we all have gone through that. People who are at a place of really recognizing all of this, we all went through that really uncomfortable journey of waking up little by little with COVID and indoctrination of education and all of these things. It's not an easy journey, but there is a point of it where you are empowered. You are left hopeful and empowered because you realize all along you've had this power, and it just took kind of going through these difficult, you know, periods of realizing that power. And so If every single one of us changed our buying habits, stopped indoctrinating our children, took away social media devices before kids have the digital self-defense skills to withstand the dangers of porn and predators, if we just made these simple changes, we are in power. These people do not have the hold that we have been indoctrinated to think they do over us.
Strong words. Rebecca, you conducted the interview, as I mentioned. I started with that part where she's saying, I felt like it really reflected the way we all feel. We're sick of this garbage. But it seems like Starbucks' message was hopeful, too. I mean, she even used the word hopeful, but I watched your entire interview. Good job. Thank you for getting that done. What other impressions did you get from talking to her and this whole thing as a whole, you know, especially the trans madness? This is another thing that you have reported on extensively. You provide a lot of the research we use here. What is your take?
My take on it is that a lot of parents are simply unaware. They're busy with their lives. They're busy trying to keep food on the table. And I mean, with the soaring inflation that we have now, they're accustomed to trusting the schools to do their jobs. And the schools are, this is ground zero for this trans agenda coming in. But it's not just in the schools. It's also social media plays a huge part. Everywhere you go, you cannot go anywhere to stores or restaurants, and everywhere you see it just in your face, accepting trans agenda. You have the rainbow, you know, they've stolen the beautiful rainbow, which was God's gift to Noah after the flood. And they've stolen that to mean something perverted. And you see it everywhere, and you see it forced on children. And of course, Target, that's one thing that Landon really pushes for. She says, don't just boycott these places for just a week or a month. It's got to be a permanent boycott.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's a good idea.
Right now, she said that the thing is they're being pushed from above. You know, they'll have their IPOs withdrawn, and they won't be able to list on the stock exchange anymore if they don't participate in this DEI, if their DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion scores aren't high enough. And so that's why you see so many corporations backing the Gender Cool Project and Drag Queen Story Hour and the Trevor Project and all of these trans programs that are geared specifically toward youth and even preschoolers. It's insane. So people need to realize this is that documentary. They're not just blowing smoke. It is a war on children. There are huge guns in their arsenal. Yeah. And people need to realize, turn off the screens, number one, get your kids out of public school. There are alternatives that are available to you. You might think, oh, I can't do that. Yeah, you can.
You have to. You have to get right to a point where you have to realize, and Gary, like we said in our Save Our Children issues, the building, I mean, it's burning. You have to get your kids out. But I wanted to point something else out too. This support for trans, LGBTQ, all the nonsense, it's fabricated. The reason I started with Starbucks' first statement being people are sick of this garbage is because there is no majority support. It's fabricated. Like Rebecca said, there's pressure from up top to have these DEI programs. There's pressure from the boards. But on the ground, from the people, the citizens have overwhelmingly said no.
I believe you're absolutely correct about that. But of course, the powers that be want us to think otherwise.
Yes.
They want us to
think that
there's something wrong with us because we believe in traditional morality, which actually is the only morality, upon which civilization and freedom can be built. So that they want us to think that we're the ones who are crazy. But what is so exciting about that interview, the part that you chose for this program, Paul, is the fact that Landon Starbuck is saying, you know, I've been red-pilled. I don't know if she used the actual phrase red-pilled, but I'm awakening. Other people have, as a result of COVID, as a result of other people, other things that have happened. The American people are waking up, and that is the hope of our civilization.
Yeah.
The fact that people are waking up.
Yes, it's certainly happening. And I like to say, I like to think that we are playing a role in that.
Absolutely.
You're at the helm here of a magazine that has been telling the truth. I guess this is a part where we pat ourselves in the back. I didn't mean to get
that. See, we can do that.
They didn't plan this out, but that's part of it. And like she was saying, you have to opt out, not just that of Target and whatnot, but you know, she's in the interview, and I'm not sure if that was included in there too, but she's like, you know, learn to grow your own food. Get a community and things like that. These are things that we should have been doing in the first place. But Rebecca, I guess it's better late than never, right?
Well, yeah, kind of. And it is quite late because this has been going on for much longer. I mean, people think that it just started in maybe 2020. No. And that's why the John Birch Society has been around. That's why Robert Welch founded the John Birch Society back in the 50s to warn people. And he even warned people they're after your cars. And look what's happening. He warned people about the conspiracy. And of course, the CIA demonized that term and made everybody who used the word conspiracy look like a kook. But yeah. Now it's not so kooky after everything that's happened since 2020, is it?
You have a pretty good archive of JBS history in your head. But we did have a program that was aimed at the social depravity that was coming up. And that was Motor Read. Am I correct?
Yes. I'm not sure.
Yes. Move it to restore decency.
Yeah. And I know we have internal conversations about perhaps bringing something like that back, because that was important. And that I think is actually the foundation of a stable civilized society, is to have decency, to have good morals. Yeah,
without morality, you cannot have freedom.
No, absolutely. And that's why they want to destroy it. Thank you, Rebecca. Thank you, Gary.
Imprisonment, forced labor, permanent separation from my family, perhaps death. I knew what could happen to people who were caught trying to defect. But the watchtowers stood yards away. The possibility of a new life in a different world, one without tyranny, was within sight. The West. I thought of the rewards no longer crushed under the boot of communism. I would work and make money, no longer restrained by the chains of collectivism. I would say what I wanted, without fear of spies and informants nearby. I would be free. The frozen rain and Romanian mud seeped through my gloves and cloths. I fantasized about a fire burning in the wood stove of my parents' home. But I pushed those thoughts from my mind, closed my eyes, and waited for the cover of the darkness.
Get Defector, a true story of tyranny, liberty, and purpose by Mark Hobovkovich with Paul Dragoo, a thrilling page-turner that will remind you how precious yet vulnerable freedom is. Available at shopjbs.org or Amazon. For a limited time, get 20% off your entire order using promo code DEFECTOR20 when you purchase Defector at shopjbs.org.
Back in November 2022, Republicans barely took back control of the House and barely failed to take back the Senate in the red wave that never rose. The number of principal constitutional Republicans in the House rose significantly, while a number of rhinos were shown the door by constituents fed up with politics as usual. The new GOP class of the 118th Congress has been dominated by young blood trying to rouse the traditional GOP from its complacency. A group of rabble-rousers have actually stood up to the aggressive, lawless tactics of the radical left, which is bent on destroying the republic as we know it. From the early going, the Young Turks in the GOP tried to force the stupid party to change course, starting with fierce opposition to establishment rhino Kevin McCarthy as speaker. After McCarthy's repeated cave-ins to Democrat pressure, the GOP, led by Matt Gaetz, ousted him as speaker and eventually settled on Mike Johnson to take his place. But Johnson can't draw a line in the sand either, and the song remains the same. Lots of tough GOP talk, followed by late-night wheeling and dealing, and then the inevitable surrender, time and time again, to everything the Democrats want. We are more than a year into this feckless Congress, and we still have no clear path to impeach the criminal in the Oval Office, nor any congressional action to secure the southern border. And now there's a new wrinkle. With an election looming in November, the House GOP, its complacency shattered by the likes of Gaetz, MTG, and other genuine agents of change, is apparently on the verge of falling apart and into minority status. This will be the first time in American history that any party has ever accomplished this. Two rhinos and ever-Trumpers, Colorado's Ken Buck and Wisconsin's Mike Gallagher are the most recent to leave. This follows McCarthy's abrupt departure and George Santos' expulsion, all of which have reduced the GOP House majority to a single vote. Here's GOP Congresswoman Claudia Tenney of New York warning we could see a House Speaker, Hakeem Jeffries, before next year's new Congress is even sworn in.
We are seeing our own majority eviscerate before our eyes with early retirements, which is unfortunate. And we are the last line of defense against this horrible policies that you're seeing with the Biden administration, with everything. And all we have is this Republican majority, as small as it is. Mike Johnson's trying to get us through, get us a greater majority, win the Senate, get President Trump back in office, and get us back on track. This is almost going to be irreparable if we lose the majority.
Keep the attention on Biden.
Absolutely.
Awesome,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Look, why is Mike Gallagher from Wisconsin, he's leaving late. Look, that seat remains open. But if he leaves, I think by April 2nd or April 5th or someday, then they can have an election. It's a Republican district. What does Gallagher think he's doing?
I don't know. I'm urging him. He came in with Mike and I as freshmen, too. And he's got to stay. If he stays early, we can get the special election. It's a very safe Republican seat.
Right.
We'll add to our majority. We don't have the other special to fill Kevin McCarthy's seat until April 30th. And we were perilous. We could end up being having a Speaker Hakeem Jeffries in the interim here while we're waiting for special elections. Personally, if you're going to make a commitment to the people that elect you, that you're going to serve for 2 years, unless you have a really good reason not to serve, then why would you do that? And aren't we Team Republican? I hate to be political here because it's a money show, but we're talking about money. We're talking about saving our economy. We're talking about all the things you talk about. Without the Republicans in office, we're going to lose all of these great things that we have as a country, self-governance, free market system. All those things are eroding away from us because we don't have a Republican.
You've got people saying that this Mike Gallagher is a traitor because he's going to diminish. I mean, it'll be not one vote majority, which could easily go away. Somebody's sick. Somebody's, whatever. This is terrible.
All right, Steve, I'm going to go to you first. I think you hinted at this quite a few weeks ago, maybe even more than that. It sure seems coordinated. And I got to say, as far as the left, this has got to be one of the most brilliant illustrations of devious tactics that I've ever seen.
Okay, well, let's unpackage this a little bit. First of all, it's about a lot more than money, with all due respect to Congresswoman Tierney. Obviously, but it is emphatically not a question of the Republicans are going to save the day. Now, a lot of cynics like to say that, at least it used to be fashionable to say that there's not a dime's worth of difference between Republicans and Democrats. But that's not strictly true. What is true is that the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, at least as long as living memory, are deliberately contrived by the uniparty establishment to play complementary roles. So, in effect, the Democratic Party is, as people like Mark Levin have correctly observed, it is the American Marxist Party. It is the party that is the primary agent for change that is pushing most of this radical agenda most overtly and increasingly demanding absolute conformity in the ranks in support of this agenda, which is why you don't see any more pro-life Democrats in Congress or in governor's mansion, this kind of thing. Now, the Republican Party, by contrast, is the party, as we've said before in the show, that is designed to lose gracefully. So if the Democrats are the Harlem Globetrotters, the Republicans are the Washington Generals. It's choreographed. They're supposed to lose, but to lose in a way that convinces people that their intentions are good, and by gum, next time they'll get it right. There's always an excuse. Well, it's an election year, and we don't want to turn off the voters. Well, we don't have a large enough majority. Well, we're worried that some of our people are in districts that were won by Joe Biden, and we could and on and on and on. The litany of excuses never ends. What we're seeing now is this remarkable unfolding event. I guess we call it, political seppuku. The Republican Party, and more importantly, its masters in the establishment, the deep state, are signaling their intention to sabotage the Republican Party so that it, in effect, resigns itself into minority status and they can get back to the business of aggressively promoting as much of the radical left agenda, including, of course, untrammeled immigration, blocking any further impeachments or investigations into the Biden crime family. Yeah. in the interval between now and November's election, and then hopefully, of course, sabotage the election as well so that they can keep the party going indefinitely. There's a lot at stake here, but people need to understand the architecture of what's going on and not say, as we just heard in the interview, well, it all depends on the Republicans to save the day.
Yeah.
They're determined not to save the day, and they're fully prepared sabotage themselves to prevent that from happening.
They were never there in the first place to do that. But apparently, Gary, nobody told MTG, nobody told Matt Gaetz, even Rosendale and all these folks, and Mike Lee and whatnot, that their purpose was to lose gracefully. I'm gonna play the Gary role here and say that I think part of the silver lining here is that we are seeing the words of Carol Quigley come out to be true, which is that there really is a uniparty, that there is no that the Republicans were never meant to be the total opposition, because when true opposition rose, this is what happens.
Well, like you said, I'm going to provide the silver lining. And the silver lining is that not all Republicans are alike. There are Republicans who are different.
Yeah.
There are Republicans who actually abide by their oath, their solemn oath to the Constitution. Can you imagine that, Paul?
Yeah.
And they include people like Matt Gaetz,
and of course there are others. There's a number
and,
of them.
And as you have pointed out, not today, but you pointed out previously, the number of Republicans who fall in that category is a growing number, because both you and I are old enough to remember, if you go back, what would you say, a couple decades ago or several decades ago, you had Larry McDonald, who happened to be a Democrat, but he was a constitutionalist. You had people like Dr. Ron Paul, who was in Congress. And there were maybe, you know, there was one of them or two of them or three of them. And
yeah.
Today there are what? There are maybe a couple dozen. So that is very, very exciting.
Yeah, there's enough to rouse up trouble for the uniparty. That's exactly what we're seeing.
Right.
There's now enough. And now I'm wondering if this is going to cause the constitutionalists, Republicans, which Steve may take, he may not agree with that term, but now there's enough of them to see, okay, this is their playbook. So maybe they're up their game next Congress. What do you think, Steve, with a few remaining?
Well, I would caution against identifying the Republican Party with the people who get elected, okay? That's only a small part of the Republican Party. The people who matter, the big money donors, all of the non-elected people who run the party machinery.
Where the power truly comes from.
Where the party truly, that determines who actually gets on the ballot, who gets to run, et cetera, et cetera. That is still a wholly controlled asset.
On the national level. But on the state level, you do see hope in some states.
There is hope in some states, for example. But the question is whether there'll be hope in enough states.
Yeah, Texas in its platform has a provision calling for getting the United States out of the UN.
Hey, America. How tired are you of mainstream corporate media's biased narratives and manipulated news? Their dishonesty and attempts to influence this generation have been exposed, put on display for anyone who's even half paying attention. But the New American Magazine has been an honest source of news and commentary for over 50 years. This is your opportunity to receive the stalwart of principled journalism at a deep discount. Picture a beautifully published magazine arriving at your doorstep twice a month, packed with insightful stories written with integrity. It's also available digitally on the New American's mobile app. Get up to speed with intelligent coverage from a freedom perspective. Right now, for a limited time, the New American is available to radio listeners at a 25% discount on a new subscription. Visit thenewamerican.com/radio25 and receive 25% off. Subscribe today at thenewamerican.com/radio25.
And we're back. Okay, guys, let's start out by talking about the difference between non-interventionism and isolationism. Whenever we say non-interventionism, the other side or others paint us as isolationists, and that's supposed to be a derogatory term. It's not a good thing to be isolationist. So, Gary, why don't you start off? Is there a difference?
Oh, absolutely. And first of all, let me agree with the left in just one very narrow area. I know that isolationism is not a good thing, which, of course, is why we are smeared as being isolationists. Isolationists, I would imagine, a country like Japan years ago, you know, before well before World War II, where basically the country was closed to the outside world, and people wondered, well, what is Japan like? Because
like we didn't North
know
Korea
because
now.
It was isolated from the, literally isolated from the rest of the world, or maybe North Korea today would be another example.
Yeah.
But non-intervention is a policy, a foreign policy based on minding one owns business and not getting involved with entangling alliances, not getting involved with the affairs of other countries, but not isolationist in that you have relations with other countries, you have commerce with other countries. You have people...
treaties? Can you have treaties with other countries?
We could have, but not a multilateral treaty, but a treaty, different treaties with different countries where it's bilateral.
Yeah.
And where people have a lot to do with each other, people associate with each other from different countries. But that is the kind of association that avoids war because people really do not want to have war. Mm-hmm. And when people know each other better, they understand another culture, they understand people in another country, they associate with each other through trade and whatnot, that is something that is a stumbling block against going to war. Where on the other hand, government does have an interest in war, and when governments get involved with each other in a way where they're trying to determine each other's policies and whatnot, that is a recipe for war.
Steve, is there any difference between, say, if European countries, Central European and Western countries especially, had treaties versus them being part of NATO? Because maybe someone's listening is like, well, how would that be any different? Or would it be just because they have these agreements between each other and not necessarily part of a bigger pact? Does that make sense?
If I understand your question... The question is between what Gary mentioned, bilateralism versus multilateralism.
Yes.
And I mean, our multilateralism was this idea that was birthed in the Congress of Vienna after the end of the Napoleonic Wars in Europe, became the basis for the Quintuple Alliance and the Holy Alliance, and eventually, in due course, the creation of the League of Nations after World War I. This idea that there ought to be multilateral coercive solutions to regional conflicts and so forth. And so on. We won't get into the history of that. Bilateralism, by contrast, is this idea that you have bilateral treaties with countries. Now, it's important to note that not all treaties are military treaties. The first and actually longest continuous treaty that the United States has had is with, of all places, Morocco, and it was entered in I believe.
How do you know this stuff?
Well, it was entered in 1785, and there was a slight military component. There, the motive was the Moroccan government was. Part of the problem, the larger problem of the depredations of Muslim pirates that were basically state-sponsored by the various Mediterranean kingdoms on the Mediterranean coast of Africa that were preying on...
Is this Jefferson's campaign against the Barbary pirates?
No, that's later. That's a generation later, okay? Yeah. But so we decided to make a treaty with the Kingdom of Morocco of friendship and peace, and that treaty remains to this day. And it's probably part of the reason that when we have problems... with different parts of the Islamic world, they never seem to include Morocco. I've never been to Morocco, but I hear tell it's actually a pretty nice place. The Atlas Mountains there and Casablanca.
Yeah,
and all these,
that's all I know about Morocco.
Sure. And so, but no one thinks of Morocco in the same way that we think of Iran or Syria or these other places that are clearly adversarial to us. So that's been a very successful treaty. And aside from the fact that it was entered into with the hope of staving off Moroccan depredations of American shipping, there is really no military component to it. We're not bound to go defend Morocco in the event that they're invaded by Algeria or Spain or something like that, right? But we're talking about something a little different. Now, I just wanted to qualify, though, one thing that Gary was saying. The non-interventionist credo is not absolute. There's one very, very flagrant exception to that. That I think we support here, and that is the Monroe Doctrine, this idea that we do have a certain responsibility to make sure to basically defend fellow countries in the Western Hemisphere against, and I the Monroe Doctrine is often mischaracterized, but its original form, the idea was that if the countries of Latin America and elsewhere in the New World are successful in becoming independent, that we would, look very unfavorably about attempts by any old world power to recolonize them. Okay, now that's why
that would be Spain.
That's precisely why France invaded and tried to colonize Mexico while we were busy with the American Civil War. They saw an opportunity there, And it's not no accident that once the war was over, they got their butts kicked by the Mexican and they left. Okay, so that I think is a reasonable exception that we did the Monroe Doctrine sort of said we do have a certain moral responsibility to our fellow countries in the Western Hemisphere to protect them, protect the New World against the depredations of the old, So there is that, and then there's the fact that. We do have this issue today that much as we would like to wish it away, won't go away. And that is that there are a few countries very far away from us who in times of yore we could have simply just ignored if we didn't like them, but that possess the ability to immolate American cities at the push of a button. Russia is one of them. China is another. North Korea, if not now, very soon perhaps, will constitute a third. All three regimes are quite hostile to the United States.
And they're nuclear armed, huh? That's
what they are nuclear armed, and this is a problem that we have to deal with. That said, a lot of what happened, we could do a lot more to build up our defenses. Yeah. I remember when Ronald Reagan proposed that it was quickly, ridiculed as Star Wars and stupid, because, of course, the globalists realized that if we actually were to set up a sort of a nuclear version of the Israeli Iron Dome, that would pretty much be impervious to incoming nukes from abroad, that would really get rid of one of the major justifications for the New World Order,
yeah,
which is protection against the nuclear holocaust. Mm. If we were to simply, create a truly credible,
yeah,
barricade against incoming nukes, incoming bombers, and all this sort of thing.
So, Gary, we don't need a New World Order to protect us from
nuclear
holocaust.
I remember that
holocaust,
as well, but I just want to interject something, and I'm sure you know this, Steve, but I bet a lot of our listeners and viewers do not know this, but when Ronald Reagan was advocating for that Star Wars-type technology.
The SDI.
Strategic Defense Initiative. Mm-hmm. He said that once it's developed, that we would give it to the Soviet Union. And that they would have it as well. And of course, that's not the solution. But we are living in a dangerous world, and which is why George Washington, for example, because principles do not change over time. Applications may change, but principles are eternal, made the point that we need to be prepared for war is the best way of being able to prevent war from happening.
Yeah, that whole strength through peace theory. And I'd imagine that applies because a lot of countries aren't going to want to mess with anyone who they think they're going to get their butts whooped by.
But we have deliberately, and we've written about this a lot over the decades, we deliberately allow ourselves, we self-sabotage our ability to protect against nukes because the doctrine is mutually assured destruction. As long as both sides' destruction is assured, went the logic, then they're not likely to embark on any war. The real reason, of course, is that we can continue to brandish the nuclear specter and cow and intimidate you into this sort of new world military order under the UN.
Well, you could say that mutual assured destruction is a policy long-term is madness, because obviously we should not be in that position to begin with. Look at Iran, for example. And so we should be able to defend ourselves. And just to wrap up, we should get back to a non-interventionist foreign policy, the policy of the founding fathers, and we should get out of all the entangling alliances, including the United States and NATO.
Yeah.
And Nations and NATO.
I'm sorry, the United Nations.
Did you say United
Thank
States?
You.
Let's not get out of the United States.
Let's not get out of the United States.
Get ahead of ourselves.
No, I think you guys did a great job of making the point that we can still be secure and not have this global order. Thank you so much, gentlemen. Thank you for hashing that out. It was a great conversation. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to another episode of New American Daily. Remember to visit thenewamerican.com for more truth-binding news. Have a good weekend, and we will see you on Monday.